You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Vandenberg. I'm the program director for the Democracy and Power Fund, a program within U.S. programs at the Open Society Institute. We're really excited to have Marcy Westerling join us as a fellow here. For over 25 years, Marcy Westerling has been a leader in organizing, educating, and mobilizing grassroots responses to violence, bigotry, and injustice in rural communities. Marcy founded the Rural Organizing Project, ROP, in 1992 to develop the ongoing capacity of pro-democracy groups in rural and small-town communities in Oregon. Under Marcy's leadership, this network of human dignity groups has grown to include over 60 organizations representing nearly every county in the state. And as Lenny Bernardo from the fellowship program said when I walked into this room today, if you Google rural organizing, you will inevitably find that the first 20 entries all refer to Marcy's work at the Rural Organizing Project, and she's really a nationally and internationally known leader in rural organizing strategies. And she's committed to a broad agenda of social change. This organization is really the first of its kind in the state of Oregon and has since become a national model. The ROP is noted for its work in not only empowering rural, small-town, and frontier activists to develop and use their progressive voice, but also for linking issues through transformational organizing, which understands the long-term nature of justice work. Fully inclusive democracy is the frame through which issues are woven together and approached, and this values-based model of community organizing emerged as a thoughtful blending of Marcy's primary organizing experiences, first in traditional direct action organizing, and then in the more feminist traditions of the personal as political, anti-racist work as core, and the interconnections between class, race, and gender organizing. This model at the Rural Organizing Project has been featured in videos, magazines, websites, blogs, journals, national radio shows, including a book called Lessons from the Field, Organizing in Rural Communities, which leads off with a chapter by Marcy. In 2006, NYU, New York University, published Building Alliances, Collaboration Between CAUSA, which is an immigrant rights organization in Oregon, and the ROP in Oregon. It's an ethnography by researchers Lynn Stephen and Jan Lanier, together with Marcy and Ramon Ramirez, who's the co-founder of the statewide immigrant rights coalition in Oregon called CAUSA. The publication led to a national speaking tour with Ramon and Marcy, featuring their productive partnership, which has become a core case study for foundations examining best practices for collaborations that work. Marcy's won a ton of awards. I won't go into them here. One of them is being selected, however, among 3,000 nominations by the Ford Foundation as a recipient of the Leadership for a Changing World Award. Marcy, as she mentioned, lives in Scappoose, Oregon. She's lived there since 1986, was raised in a small town here in New York, so welcome home. She graduated with honors from Smith College and has lived and organized in Italy, Iowa, Massachusetts, and Minnesota. And I'll just say, I worked in Colorado for about 15 years, and I'd long heard of Marcy's great work in building rural support for social justice issues, for taking on the divide-and-conquer strategies of right-wingers around issues related to equality, public investment, LGBTQ equality, immigrant rights, and many other issues. I know firsthand that many progressive, self-identified progressives and social justice activists tend to write off rural America as a lost cause. So as a longtime organizer and someone who grew up in a small town of 1,800 people in Maine, I'm very excited that Marcy's joining OSI to help inform our grant-making, our strategies, our thinking. And I'm sure that many of us are concerned about rising right-wing populism that we're seeing in this nation. And Marcy's work to map organizations in Colorado, Idaho, Washington, and Nevada, and map the social justice infrastructure there, from religious organizations and public libraries to social service agencies and civil rights coalition. It's really her aim to revitalize a movement for social justice and to slow the breakdown of our civic institutions. And as some may have seen in the invitation to this session, among other topics, she'll discuss the challenges and opportunities of rural organizing after the election of Barack Obama and responding to the growing threat from the right. So thanks to everyone for joining us, and welcome, Marcy.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. My mother would have loved all of that. And, of course, in Scappoose, Oregon, I'm just known as the local whack job who bikes 10 miles back and forth to work with my 18-year-old terrier mutt. And when I go grocery shopping, the only question of concern people have is, where's your dog? So I'm very important. But what I would love to do today, and I understand that fire laws do not allow me to lock the doors and keep us in here for a full 6 hours, is kind of create as much level of shared thinking around rural America as possible, including what this project is, but we only have so much time, and so my default mode is always going to be evangelize around why we do want to be as inclusive as possible with rural America. And so given that, I'm going to talk just a little bit about why, what are the values of organizing in rural communities, then why and what is this model, and then try and apply that for some relevance, if you haven't been convinced yet, for 2010. So hopefully that's why you're here. And I'm also very, very mindful of wanting to get as many of your questions and input as possible, and so at a certain point, if I have not shut up, please I'll help that happen. But I will take off my watch and make sure. So in terms of why rural, some of the things that I would encourage us to think about is, first of all, from a strategic point of view, this is where the right, however we want to define that, is claiming their foot soldiers. And they're saying that this is where they can still find good old-fashioned America, whether that's a racist America or however else people want to define it, that this is where the right can go and find the kind of welcome that they want. And in fact, that's not necessarily not true. Double negatives, I try and avoid them, but rely on them a lot anyway. So the culture wars really come out of rural America. And in fact, that is the Achilles heel of the left. And anyone, again, who's approaching organizing from a strategic perspective would probably want to look at why you are cognizant of your Achilles heel and responding accordingly. The other thing around rural America is it's a perfectly scaled laboratory. So unlike so many places that we are committed and will stay committed to organizing, when you go into a rural community, it's kind of like cooking dinner in a kitchen where every ingredient is immediately available, as compared to, oh, dang, you know, I don't have that spice or whatever. It's all there. And so it's just a much better laboratory for testing methodologies and for seeing results. And I would contend that, in fact, the only real differences between rural and other communities is, you know, we have longer distances to travel, especially in the West. Horrendously huge distances, but that's something we're used to. We have more isolation, although the internet has changed that, but an isolation that can really promote people feeling vulnerable. And there is no such thing as anonymity. And so again, that's a variable that it does need to be factored in. The third idea that I would promote in terms of rural America is I actually think it's one of the last places left in this country where you have ideological integration. And so that segregation of people's thinking that's really been allowed in recent decades by zip code has, you know, made the left, you know, kind of go on endlessly about, you know, we're preaching to the choir. Well, you're only preaching to the choir if you only talk to the choir. And in rural America, you don't have that luxury. So that natural inclination to find people that think the same way, well, you're not going to go to Little League, you're not going to go to work, you're not going to go to school, you're really going to not function at all if you're really trying to stay within the comfort zone of people who think like you. And ideological integration is pretty important because it allows you to converse with real people, and organizing is fairly dependent on that. So then the last thing, which really ties into these other points, is rural organizing forces common sense organizing, because your ability to stay functioning, to not need to relocate and lose your job and be shunned, which is never the most attractive option, depends on being able to talk with people where they're at. And so we can study endlessly enormously important works from Drew Weston and George Lakoff and all the rest that tell us, you know, how the brain functions. But, you know, there's no better way to become an expert than to have to navigate that in order to get your groceries and get back home again. So that common sense kind of organizing is a little bit of a basic when you're trying to do it in rural communities. So then that brings me to why this model. And I'd like to start just a little bit historically on what is the model and then talk about what the model is that I'm trying to be successful with in 2010 through OSI. So first of all, my political frame is very much based on realizing very early on that I was a total coward. You know, that really, if you put me in a snowball fight, I just couldn't bear it. So, you know, so that level of cowardice really informed my own motivations. The other thing that really informed me was coming from a family where I was a first-generation American. My father had come over after the World War II from Dutch resistance movement, growing up in a home with Jews in hiding and watching his father be incarcerated by the Nazis as a resistance fighter. So, you know, my organizing was very, very informed by kind of that lore. And I can remember even as an elementary school teacher, I was never that, but sounds good. When I was in elementary school, that the question that I was most inclined to want to talk to my grandfather about was, you know, when do you choose to pick up guns? When do you know that that's the appropriate response? And how do you avoid getting to that moment? So again, a really extreme kind of organizing model as compared to being motivated because, oh, I'd like to elect this candidate, or I'd like to defeat this idea or promote this idea. And then also, as someone who lives in small town communities, that really shapes my own, you know, I have enormous self preservation instinct to have some friends. And so again, that was part of my political frame. And then I think anyone who has not read Chris Hedges' work, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and that where he really looks at his war, frontline war experiences across the globe to understand why it is that we have such phenomenal rates of civil war right now, and an organizing model that really, really, really ultimately is trying to disallow the possibility for Scappoose, Oregon, to become a front line of any kind of civil war, and from that, rural America. So the Rural Organizing Project is implicitly lean and mean in design. That's partially because it was never intended to exist as a funded model. When I first started doing the work, it was being on the front lines of watching our very small town meet until post-midnight in a standing room only, move to the gymnasium kind of audience, discussing whether or not we would make creationism the law of the land. And we won by one vote, but that was kind of the wake-up call for me, who already had a full-time job within the domestic violence movement in the same rural county, to look at how do we create progressive infrastructure that can better anticipate this happening and have made it a debate that did not go on until 1 a.m. And so we designed our own model in Columbia County, where I live, and then did, through solidarity, approached other leaders of the domestic violence movement and said, hey, this is what we're seeing in Columbia County. What are you seeing in your county? And would it be helpful if we kind of drove over there and coordinated a living room conversation about what you're seeing, talked about what we're seeing kind of globally with the rise of the right, and you guys could decide whether or not you wanted to create a human dignity group. So that, in a nutshell, is the model. And it was designed to be lean and mean because there was no organization to support that, it was very much a peer calling out of other good, good citizens who were very disturbed, kind of that uh-oh feeling in the pit of your stomach with the way things were going, the number of censorship efforts, the anti-gay vitriol, the anti-abortion. In Oregon in 1990, we ran a gubernatorial candidate, we being a very generous we, who as part of his platform had the full quarantining of all gays and lesbians, and he won the vote of 1 out of 5 rural Oregonians. So if that's not a wake-up call, I don't know what is. And so the idea was to really support these folks in these towns in finding other people, creating a shared analysis that was not about any single issue, but instead was looking at the variety of ways that democracy, inclusive democracy as we understood it, was under the gun. And so creating infrastructure that allowed a core group of people to be the decision makers, a larger group of people to become the supporters who would cycle in and out of doing actual work, whether it was baking cookies or phone banking during a peak moment in our civic engagement cycle. But whatever, but the real idea was to have that structure to create that action plan that we could reflect on after every year and also use as our narrative going into the next year, and then have a communication system that really allowed people to understand that they were not alone in feeling like, oh, everything's going bad here. So that was the basic strategy. And the role of the ROP when we first started to imagine ourselves as existing was, again, with no staff, no office for years. We started out with a budget of $10,000 and have never had a budget over $200,000, which, again, in a lean and mean kind of organizing model is an interesting one to study, is how we can work with 70 different human dignity groups, all of which we've had some level of design, be the lead kind of lifeline to them in the 10th largest geographic area in the nation, and do that with 2 to 4 staff at our peak. And how we have done that is really with enormous intimacy. So I think, again, as we look at the models that are developing around us and what allows people to delete a message or what allows people to read a message, which, of course, we can now track in every possible way, the fact that we sleep in people's houses, they are responsible for putting the gas in our car, they are actually responsible for donating the car that we arrive in, the auto mechanics are responsible for keeping it going. So, I mean, people really, really, really own the rural organizing project. Our office is quite humble, but it's been totally transferred, been transformed from a pit to a semi-pit, with brigades coming in from all around the state and doing that. And so there's just that enormous amount of, this is who we are, we will continue to exist. What that means, though, is that since a core role of the ROP is to develop analysis, so when we came out of the pretty intense anti-gay moment of 92, which was really an international moment where we were the first state to have a public vote on whether or not we should remove a group of people from due protection, which happened to be gays and lesbians and necrophiliacs, but that got dropped. And so that was a real international moment of looking in. And so at that point, it was fairly easy to bring out people who are willing to say, this is wrong, I will be an activist, I will be an organizer. Well, then that moment passes, and you have all the other things that you have to do every day. Well, one of the things that we started doing as soon as that election was over was talking about immigration. And where it would be very predictable if we had an analysis of the right and what was their motivations, that really where we could expect to see them showing up next would be around immigrants and what that would look like in Oregon. So our strategy is very much around inoculation of what are the conversations that we need to have to take, you know, good citizen Bill and equip him to actually not just get, you know, he got why it was not okay to create this policy against queers in 1992 because he had Uncle Joe and it was in his family. But, you know, we had ample documentation that Bill wouldn't necessarily get why it is that immigration backlash had any relevance. And in fact, a lot of our leaders were really equipped to work for English only because in their thinking, what would be a better way to welcome in new community members than to make sure we were all speaking the same language? So a very, very common sense solution that if we weren't out there to actually talk about why that might be hostile or why we would want to be thoughtful about it, et cetera, et cetera. So we do a lot of developing that intimacy to have those hard conversations so that in general we've had very little reduction of our supporters over the years, which is not to say we don't get hate mail, which is not to say that I can't walk out the front door and find a flag from the Confederacy there. You know, so it's not to minimize that there's not a little bit of concern over what we're trying to do, but it does mean that when we try and push a new way of connecting the dots to someone like Bill, he's really inclined to take the time to puzzle through it with us rather than saying, you're pushing me too far. So that's pretty core to how we work. The other thing that I would mention before going into the specifics of this process project is the whole acceptance of the notion of ebb and flow. So I think there's a lot of tendency when groups of activists stop doing their work to say, well, that's over, and to kind of shut them down. And we've really tried to encourage people to anticipate that they'll have moments of being very, very active and successful, and they'll have moments, you know, three people move out of town, you know, whatever, where they're going to barely exist. And we refuse to let them to stop doing business. And instead, we say, gone fishing. You know, we give them a lot of permission to be less active so that when we need them to reengage, it's not about starting from scratch. And so that's a core role of the Rural Organizing Project is to be that historical memory and keep those connections going. So the project itself in 2010 is for me to leave the work I've done in Oregon and actually to look at how would we reduce our model in 2010 for going into states that Nebraska, for example, has 93 counties. And if we kind of map the existing progressive infrastructure, what we find is that their base of supporters and friends are very, very clustered in the few cities that you may be able to A, fly into, or B, name. And so there's really no starting point. And in some instances, there's little motivation to actually change that. So people are like, sure, if you can do it, great. You know, not sure what we'll do in 2011 with all these new people, which I've actually been told. But, you know, sure, come on in. And so the idea is, first of all, to try and motivate, just like I am here, why it is that in Nebraska, they're just not going to get the kind of policy victories that they feel so pressured to produce if they're not looking at where does their legislature come from, what is their legislators hearing from, and just kind of what's that whole process. And I use the legislative as just one of any number of examples of how we would measure change. So you just can't do that if in the predictable zip codes of Lincoln and Omaha, you're yet again, advocating for the predictable position. The legislators just roll their eyes and say they're there, and then go home to their communities where, in fact, no one is encouraging them to think differently about how we do policy and how we create inclusive democracy. So the core point is to, A, get those groups that are already doing in charge of progressive organizing to decide that rural communities are of value, and then to actually show them just how easy it is. Now, of course, it actually really isn't that easy, I mean, depending on how you want to look at it. And it's especially not nearly as easy to do it kind of as a visitor, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm trying to figure out how to do it in Nebraska or Idaho or Washington or Colorado in a way that makes it really have some depth and have some continuation that the local groups can maintain. So that's the project parameters. Some of the ways that I'm trying to do it, and hopefully you'll just have all kinds of brilliant ideas and can share them with me, is one, really looking at what are some repeat ways that we can, for example, go to every library in every county. So my county, which is 645 square miles as compared to Manhattan's, well, I guess Manhattan isn't a county. But anyway, so a pretty large land mass. Oh, all right, see? So we have five different library jurisdictions. So each of those libraries makes their own decisions. How can we troll by calling them, asking some basic questions, and look for those warm bodies? Now, you might say, every librarian has a good sense of inclusive democracy. Why would you even need to test that assumption out? Well, in my community, you know, we can go to the library and look at the Catholic crosses on each of the books that is used as a designation to show that it's a good, it's a kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval that it will offend no one. And we've had to work very long and hard to, after 20 years, make some impact in who's on the Friends of Library Board, whether or not they continue to see this country as a Christian nation, as they proudly announced, and whether or not they could understand why a Catholic cross was not a fair or legal way to designate books that were non-offensive. So anyway, so yes, we do need to troll. The same with the sheriff's departments, the same with the community action agencies, the food banks, et cetera. Can we find those bright lights and really then use that initial person in each of these communities to find who else they know that if they go to the grocery store and they're in line with that person, it's safe to say something about, boy, do you know what happened in Massachusetts? Man, scary. You know, so really how they can test and how they, who they can create safety with, bring those people together in a living room where basically the content of that brainstorming discussion, because no one wants to be invited to another meeting, so the brainstorming discussion is really kind of 20 minutes of doing an update on, you know, what is going on globally, 20 minutes of really having people narrate their own place in that, you know, what does it look like in Scappoose, Oregon? So they're kind of credentialing that it really is a big deal. And then the rest of the time is spent on, well, how can we create a group that creates increasing comfort and safety for growing the number of people that identify with a progressive vision? So that, in a nutshell, is what I would want to say. Do I have time to throw in a quick story?
Yes.
Well, yay. of course, nothing I say is very quick. But Sarah Palin, who actually was someone who was educated through the Constitution Party, which is a very strong force in the West, and in and actually kind of the lead of the Constitution Party, is functioning right outside my own office window. And so I know I've become a deep fan of their work over the years. And I think of how 20 years ago, our job was really, you know, they would set up in front of the post office with a sign, the only post office, of course, and the only grocery store with a sign saying, you know, do you think homosexuality is a sin? Sign here, and big lines of people. And meanwhile, a lot of people were just not able to even feel like they could get their groceries or pick up their mail given that hostility. And so our immediate response was to set up a counter table right next to them, kind of saying, you know, does that offend you? So, you know, we tried to be neutral and provide a safe harbor, but obviously that was a slight irritation to the Constitution Party, and that kind of defined our relationship. And I can remember 20 years ago literally going to a meeting that they were holding at the Public Utility District and, you know, prepared to either say they needed to let us in or they needed to relocate because of how the laws work. And so they, under the cloak of darkness, left. So, again, not a very great relationship. Now, fast forward 20 years, and I'm looking at a poster that says the Constitution Party is looking for gun owners. That would be everyone. Property rights advocates, you know, blah, 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 to come to a discussion with the sheriff, which is a very important role in rural America, to discuss the Constitution. So I'm like, huh, that's great. Well, since that time, we've really, you know, tried to create tax salons with the Constitution Party and look at what are we in agreement that we would want to fund and have in our communities, et cetera, et cetera. And so we call up the Constitution, the sheriff, and say, hey, man, we're going to be there and we're going to have your back. Because you may well be aware that Sheriff Mack in Arizona is traveling the country with a great deal of venom and passion and turning out 1,000-plus people after with sheriff discussions in many, many, many a county, which is really changing how the sheriff views his job, because when you only have 1,000 people packing guns showing up with a very narrow view of the Constitution, you kind of change your thinking just a little bit. So we, having worked to elect this sheriff, having met with him over coffees around immigration law and immigration commitments and inclusive democracy, it was pretty easy to pick up the phone, send him a couple of articles around what was happening nationally and say, hey, by the way, we're going to be there, so don't you feel at all vulnerable. And sure enough, we show up, are able to now shake hands with the Constitution Party so they don't shut down the meeting, and instead have a fantastic conversation facilitated by the sheriff, shoring up actually why it is that the Constitution should be a document that we have some pride and ability to navigate with. So I just do that as a really quick snapshot of our outcomes are not about, you know, charting the incredible electoral presence that we've created in rural America for showing just how incredibly cool and progressive we are. We're not there yet. But are we able to maintain a more calm kind of community profile so that we can actually not lose at the grassroots moving forward on our path, our trajectory towards inclusive democracy? That I think we are able to do. And I think in some ways that's what we're trying to do in many, many places. And hopefully there's some compelling pieces for us all to think about together. So with that, I'd love to open it up for your questions and comments and anything else. And I'm sorry that I kind of went on and on.
If you could say your name also before you ask the question, that'd be great.
Sure. Hi, I'm Rakiba Labrie with the Equality and Opportunity Fund and U.S. Programs. And I'm very taken with the way in which you've been able to find common cause among sort of very disparate constituencies. And so in our Equality and Opportunity Fund, we make grants around racial justice, immigrant rights, gender justice, and LGBTQ rights. And we've been trying to identify themes or goals that would help to bridge the concerns of those various constituencies. And one goal is really trying to counter violence and harassment directed at people of color, gays, women, immigrants. And I know Bill introduced you by saying you have a background in domestic violence work, and you've also done work around violence in rural communities. And so I was just wondering if you could identify some successful strategies that you all have used to really try and reduce violence and hate crimes against more marginalized groups.
So one thing that we've really tried to do is document and quantify. You know, really the battered women's movement started so much around trying to say these problems exist. And we actually are going to take charge of kind of dealing with these problems, but you cannot ignore knowing these problems exist. And so the whole idea of support groups were very activist-oriented and really about creating mechanisms to start to quantify the amount of abuse that was going on. If you look at county-by-county statistics for hate crimes, especially in rural America, there is no problem out there. It is just one big place of bliss. And, of course, you know, that's really about, would you further compromise your safety by going and reporting an incident to a sheriff that's just been indoctrinated by Sheriff Mack? No. And so we've tried to create a lot of different ways for people to report what they're experiencing that's not about going through probably a less than friendly system. So I think that's really, really critical, is not saying that, oh, we're going to stop all kinds of hate violence that's pretty predominant in actually day-to-day life, but instead to say, that is wrong, and we're going to count it. And at the same time, we're going to provide you some support, and in return, also expect you to kind of find your voice and be a part of this community. So that would be our short way around it, is to create some real numbers.
Hi, Marcy. It's Bill Vandenberg again. Question for you on race in rural America. When Sarah Palin was on the campaign trail and she would go to small, rural, nearly all-white communities, or at least on TV it looked like they're nearly all-white communities, she would say, this is the real America and this is where I want to be. And, you know, my hometown of Maine was nearly all-white, but rural America is much more diverse than it ever was. And in the South, there's always been large concentrations of rural African-American folks, immigrants moving to meatpacking plants and farms around the country. When you talk about your work with the Rural Organizing Project, I have a picture in my head that tells me your base is perhaps more white, but possibly multiracial. Could you talk a little bit about your work specifically in this vein, and also how you observe kind of demographic patterns and how you think that that's shaping or shifting the conversation on rural organizing and populist movements?
So I'll probably drop a piece or two, so just remind me as I go along. But when we first started 20 years ago, we really talked about ourselves as really trying to call out white, downwardly mobile, small-town folks. And really kind of create a line of defense where they had the information to challenge dominant culture and to really resist what was coming. So that meant that our base was disproportionately and continues to be disproportionately white, as is Oregon. But well before the 2000 census, we were very, very aware of the changing demographics. And in fact, even when we started the densest concentrations of people of color were in rural Oregon. So that's always been true, but it's just about, that's also fairly random facts. That's not the broadest truth. So one of the things that we did early on is we were watching way too much coloring up of white organizations, kind of the trend. You know, if you're applying for funds, it always seems slightly lucrative to be able to show that we're not just a bunch of good white folks. Why look? And actually, our good white folks needed a lot of support to unlearn racism. a lot of support. And I can, you know, give you endless stories that are kind of amusing, but not really, of people like being in the grocery store, seeing a person of color rushing over, dropping everything to say, will you come on our board? Because, you know. So we thought that actually it would be much better to support people of color creating their own kind of human dignity group, and not to promote segregation, but to actually allow some real development of voice and development of, you know, all the ways that we would want people to be able to be good allies. And I think that's one of the reasons Bill had mentioned in the introduction that we're fairly known for working in solidarity with Causa and Pacoon in Oregon. And we cut a deal really early on and kind of talked about, you know, where we thought would be our failures as a disproportionately white movement, and why we didn't feel that coloring ourselves up was a really good strategy, and what kind of support they could create for communities of color, particularly Latino community members that showed up and wanted to be a part of a group, but might be better getting that support from Pacoon and Causa. So that became a strong part of our model. That's actually changing a lot right now, because the communities are changing so much, let alone our credibility within specifically Latino communities. And so we're getting a lot more folks that are asking to be a part of a group. We have two fully bilingual staff folks. It's still very contentious within our white organizing that they don't want to see two separate organizations exist. They want one Kumbaya kind of organization, and we've, you know, had a lot of pushback on that, but we still try and create that structure, and then folks can, you know, are supposed to be working together along those race, class, and gender divides, and race and class are a really big cofactor in Oregon.
Hi, this is Noy, another fellow, and in the course of doing my research on counter-trafficking, I've noticed a very interesting shift in the evangelical movement away from stereotypically socially conservative issues such as pro-life work or anti-gay activism, if one can call it that, and towards a more human rights-based approach in terms of looking at what they call slavery and bondage and land grabbing and human trafficking. What's been interesting about this is the way that evangelicals have been able to work cross-platform lines and cross-political lines. They've allied themselves with feminists who were very prominent in the anti-porn movement in the 80s, and also with social conservatives, with whom the evangelicals, who they're not actually necessarily conservative. Some of them are quite left-leaning or progressive. And so I'm wondering what kind of lessons this kind of cross-platform organizing can have for a rural organizing project, or if you're kind of more concerned, and justifiably so, with creating a safe space for people to organize around more specifically progressive or left-leaning issues.
We have an incredible opportunity right now in terms of, if we're not able to take advantage of the fact that there is some real momentum within the evangelical community, within just the low-wage worker community, just in general. I mean, rural Oregon is poor Oregon. And that's not true across, you know, I'm like amazed when I look at some of the unemployment figures for rural counties in Colorado and Nebraska. But my county's basically been in the 20s unemployment rate for the last 2 decades. And that's pretty typical of rural Oregon. And so, you know, that makes us very, very vulnerable to scapegoating. It also could make us very, very vulnerable to creating, you know, to looking at the Tea Party platform, for example, and building it out around what are the forms of services and policies that we need for families to be able to continue to function within our communities. So, and the evangelical opening is one among many. So trying to figure out how to use that and how to create comfort. One of the things that we're doing, like when I did a debate recently with a Constitution Party around some tax measures that are on the ballot right now in Oregon that are very, very critical. And after that debate, the head of the Constitution Party said, you know, boy, you're really being open-minded right now, and, you know, maybe we should run a congressional candidate together. And I said, well, I'm not really sure that's where we want to start. I think there might be some flaws, because they really want to bring our boys and girls home from the war, which actually, I think that would be a great idea. But there are other ways that our platform for our congressional candidate might run into trouble. So I said, how about, you know, again, we expand these living room dialogues where we really deal with how we want to make this community work. So what we've been trying to do is move people together into literally gardens, we have an intercambio that's going, and I know I'm disproportionately talking about my community, but that's because it's where I'm the most active. But, you know, it's a good example of the 70 human dignity groups across Oregon. We have an intercambio that's actively recruiting through classified ads and our own communication systems, volunteers that are willing to give 2 hours a week to training up those folks who want to get more proficient in English. And that is a great way for the evangelical community to work with the progressive community and, you know, all of the rest of it. So we're creating kind of safe harbor projects that try to build on what we agree on. And we're getting, you know, as someone who just came through a 2-year effort to try and defeat 2 very anti-immigrant ballot measures in my home community, and really stalking people to get our phone banks and our door-to-door shifts filled, it's amazing to see people show up out of the woodwork to give up 2 hours a week on these kinds of projects.
Yeah, hi, Marcy. Adam from the Source Justice Fellowships. I mean, either explicitly or implicitly, I gather from much of what you're saying is kind of making the case for why rural places matter, at least if you're speaking to an urban audience. And for the work that the fellowships, our fellowships program does, supports criminal justice reform advocates around the country. And I don't think that the case needs to be made for them, to them, given this dynamic of primarily kind of urban residents being kind of forcibly migrated upstate to rural areas where they're incarcerated. And I'm just wondering if in the work that you've done, you've either worked on this issue, and if you have kind of what your experience has been, and if you have any kind of important lessons that you think you could share with us.
Well, like any aspect of our work, it's not easy, although criminal justice, there's a lot more room right now as taxpayers' dollars dramatically dwindle to really rethinking how we're spending them. So we have a long history in Oregon of working both on the founding of the Western Prison Project. We were initially on the board of that organization, and as it became less regional in focus and more state-focused as the Partnerships for Safety and Justice in working on all of the different campaigns around kind of what criminal justice looked like in rural communities, including trying to block adding in new prisons in rural communities, which is very, very compelling when you're told that this is going to improve your desperate, dire 20-point unemployment rate by getting a prison. And so we've really worked to support kind of a grassroots thinking about why that's not true, touring some people actually from upstate New York so that they could speak firsthand on some of their own experiences. So we've really tried to have every issue, including criminal justice, be very, very present, and we're very much tracking the current census issues in terms of what it means to count prisoners in these small community county populations where, in fact, they would love to count them. So I would love to say that we're it's very present on the radar.
Yeah, sorry. I'm Marcy. I'm Tim Dorsey. I work with a U.S.-based program here at OSI called the Strategic Opportunities Fund. It's really amazing to hear about your work. And I'm so interested to hear especially about how so much of the framework has really grown out of your background in the movement against domestic violence and really coming within kind of a feminist framework. And I'm interested to hear a little bit more about where you see some of that work now vis-a-vis what's happening with the Rural Organizing Project and kind of as you all continue to develop analysis around particular kind of issues and trends, what you're seeing in terms of feminist organizing in rural America in 2010.
Or feminist organizing anywhere in 2010. It's not an area of great hope right now, I would say personally. But, you know, I think that there's a lot to learn by looking at the violence against women and the feminist movements, and in particular what it means to win your policy hopes and for them not to be at all what you had hoped for. So in specific, what the Winning the Violence Against Women Act has really meant to the frontline grassroots movement. In Oregon, you know, to some extent, we were trying to say we're going to take the burdens off of you as really the only point of kind of understanding and mandating. We wrote into the law in Oregon that you could not receive domestic violence funds unless you could document that you did an unlearning racism training and an anti-homophobia training once a year. So now that's a good policy, is to actually write yourself into the power mandates. But so we were really trying to say we will try and hold up kind of the rest of the proactive and reactive progressive agenda so that you can really deal with crisis service delivery in these vast, vast terrain, because you can also imagine that with unemployment rates as high as ours are, and a lot of people do move to rural communities to be less visible. And one of the things that our sheriff was quick to point out is that if you move to out of a city, you need to know you're entitled to no police protection. And that's a good thing to keep in mind. So anyway, I think right now, we've always, at Rural Organizing Project, tried to approach every issue with a race, gender, and class lens, and I feel like gender is the weakest everywhere. And if we talk about gender, we're really talking about queers, which is great, but that's not enough. That's not at all inclusive. And so I don't have a good answer. I'm pretty excited that going into these new states, one of the places of conversation that I'm trying to test out is the domestic violence programs to see, you know, how political are you and how much are you tracking and would you be scared to talk to me? And in fact, in Nebraska, it's been pretty much a come hither, you know, let's get down to business. So we'll see. Hopefully I'll have a very different and more comprehensive answer in a few months.
Hey, Marcy, this is Lenny Bernardo. You know, in sort of listening to the kinds of issues that you're thinking about, or the sort of human dignity groups eventually will identify, I started to think about the experience we have in Russia right now in terms of organizing, which is very difficult. And in fact, the more traditional human rights groups in Russia that focused only on sort of civil and political concerns, excluding social and economic rights as part of the agenda, are beginning to bring in social and economic questions, sort of housing, employment, et cetera, as a means to, in some ways, pave the way for people who otherwise would pay little attention to civil and political rights so that they would feel somewhat vested. And the civil and political stuff would come later. And so it's a process. I'm wondering, with the human dignity groups that you would like to see set up in the four states that you're working on, to what extent would you feel comfortable with real heterogeneity in the sense of a real sort of small-c Catholic approach, that there may be human dignity groups in which there are people who are involved who very much depart in some ways from our own kind of comfort level on some issues. Let's leave aside the question of quarantining human beings, but say people who are anti-choice,
but at the same time want to have some sense of community around other issues that are important to them. Do you see then establishing these other human dignity groups and now areas that you haven't worked really as a process and expecting that will be real elements of pluralism there and conflict, but recognizing that that is sort of fundamental for any sort of kind of future organizing?
That is a very intriguing question. I think one of the things that we've tried to do, I kind of feel like it's a question I need to sit with and come back in 24 hours, but let me take an initial stab at it, is that first of all, in most of our communities, there is no remaining moral compass. So the Bill of Rights, inclusive democracy, you know, some of the framework that I kind of got trained up with when I was in elementary school has really been removed to the point that we can't, you know, even librarians, which my mom was one, so I think that they're just very special, that we just can't count on any level of moral compass that goes back to what I think we also have deep pride in as a, you know, apple pie, America, Chevrolet, and democracy. So towards that end, we are not very inclined towards rhetoric and mandates. For example, a human dignity group, the only thing that they are not allowed to do and be in good standing with us is to discriminate against another group of people overtly. So short of that, you know, there's actually no loyalty oath. Now, we would probably, and I actually think that for our groups and for me personally, staying living in my community, abortion is the most challenging issue to stay in good standing, you know, to not have your house burnt to the ground, if you will. And if you don't have policing, you can imagine our fire departments. So we are pretty conscious of that. I guess what we don't want to do is, given that there's such an erosion of a moral compass and there's such a lack of backbone, is we don't want to create a false fight over how people interpret reproductive choice, but we don't want to give in on kind of some level of moral compass around a woman's right to choose. So it's not an edict, but we will encourage people to, you know, you can set it aside, but don't put it under the rug.
Hi, Marcy. This is Patricia from Democracy in Power. I was curious in how you talk with people from Portland and other big cities around how to be a good ally to rural organizers.
Well, we've come a long way, baby. So to some extent, you know, 20 years ago, I would go into any Portland. First of all, the only ways that rural folk could participate would be to send a check or to drive into a meeting. So those were your two options, and those were said with great sincerity and fondness. The other thing that I was told often is, well, if you want that, why wouldn't you live in the city? So, you know, I never knew that civil rights were zip code dependent. But so initially, our approach was a little bit like Robin Hood. You know, we really formed as a resistance movement to our urban brothers and sisters. And literally, I would go to every meeting with these big satchels so I could steal and plunder because, you know, it just seemed the most effective way for ensuring solidarity. And there was, I mean, there, you know, there were a lot of folks who were like early on when we really didn't exist, you know, who are like, don't worry, you know, we'll take care of you, you know, just kind of, you know, give all of your money to us and we'll make sure. So we learned a lot about, you know, who really was willing to support rural solidarity, who wasn't, and didn't spend a lot of time negotiating, but actually kind of just got what we needed. We're a little bit more grown up now, if you will, but we still maintain that we're not there to kind of do the equivalent of coloring up your table. you know, now everyone wants in Oregon to always have a certain number of rural people, and what's rural enough, and, you know, and it's like, actually, you know, we're not coming to every meeting. We're really busy. We have 90% of the state to organize, and so we're not very meeting-driven, and we're often fairly not present. And so it's been a long process to negotiate how people can keep us in the room while we're not in the room, and, you know, what that is. I would say right now, you know, no one wants to proceed in Oregon. No one. Okay, that might be slightly grandiose. Without making sure that there's some kind of rural presence. And I just think in general, like when I'm talking to, you know, states that I'm going into, there's a lot more, there's less of a sales job, although I really have had people say, you know, I don't know what we're going to do with these rural people in 2011. So, you know, I think that shows that there's still a little bit of work to be done. But I think that's actually about having a grassroots base.
Sorry, Marcy. Tim, again, from Strategic Opportunities Fund. I was just curious about the states that you referenced that you're looking closely at and going to be sort of including in your work over the course of the next year. Just curious about how you went about deciding where that was going to be.
Very randomly. You know, I hate to fly. Colorado's a direct flight. Plus, I thought Bill might like me more. Nebraska, you know, I really, Nebraska and ROP have been trying to figure out how to do solidarity support for years now. And so when this opportunity came up to be a fellow, I just felt an enormous loyalty to, you know, finally being able to say, look, I've got my end covered. Can you cover your end? So that was kind of, they deserve it. And Nebraska Appleseed is the anchor group there. In Idaho, you know, it's Idaho needs anything and everything. And there really is no progressive infrastructure there at this point. And so as it's as a neighbor, it just feels like if you can't keep your own block looking good, what are you talking about? And that same kind of theory with Washington. I am, like, desperate and really did consider, like, Pennsylvania just because, you know, anything bad happens in rural Pennsylvania. And we have absolutely no capacity to respond, you know, Arizona, God help us, you know, so I have a little bit of a hard time, you know, so that's the random nature of those four states.
If I could, folks, we'll take one more question and then we'll ask Marcy to wrap up and talk about the arc of her project here in terms of timeline, possible opportunities for continued engagement, what she might like to know and have from us in the vein of integration within OSI. So one last question and then we'll take that on.
Hi, I'm Julie Hayes. I'm with the Office of Programs. And generally at OSI, I've always focused internationally, so you'll excuse if my question is international rather than domestic. But thank you very much for your presentation. I'm wondering, you know, you spoke when you gave the history of the organization to say that it's not a single issue organization, but has it been modeled ever on a sort of single group or, you know, you say you were 1992, the peak of the anti-gay sort of rhetoric in the U.S. You know, I'm looking at it from the perspective of the Roma community in Europe and the sort of xenophobia and radical right in Europe, particularly violent, you know, hate crimes against them. And if this type of model, where and predominantly the violence is happening at the rural community level, I'm wondering if this type of modeling is applicable at all, or if you think there could be elements of it that might work at that level. And just to give you a reason for the question is that a group of Roma activists are coming to the U.S. Over the next couple of months to meet with groups like the NAACP, et cetera, to talk about mass movement mobilization, especially at the rural level. And I'm wondering if at some point, you know, you might want to speak to them or take the time to speak to them about such model movement building. Thank you.
You know, I would love the opportunity to cross-learn. I think one of the pieces... So first of all, I would really credit Suzanne Farr, who was the founder of the Women's Project in Arkansas, as being a strong mentor who's given endlessly, and just later this month will be flying out yet again to spend a week at no cost touring rural Oregon around creating a new economy. No problem. So I think the whole the commonalities are really about saying every person counts, spending some time initially really shoring up what are the needs that that community needs to come to terms with in order to have the confidence to move outward, and also to look at what's the frame of the dominant culture, and this probably there's not a lot of agreement on, so I say it with that caveat, but knowing the frame of the dominant culture to look at how the excluded community can present itself from a starting point of having something heard. So just those are some of the pieces, but I think that I would have so much to gain, and maybe from that entry point I can just move into the closing that Bill was referencing. So basically the trajectory of the project right now is to create documentation to go into the stakeholders meeting in each state by late February, early March, and to have these initial gatherings where we look around the room and see the incredibly obvious evidence that these rural counties are a drag or an opportunity, depending on how you look at it, and then to select out kind of what would be the smaller number of counties that we would tag team and go into and create a human dignity group that would be long-term in disposition, so that we would work together on that. And at the same time, to try and do repeat conversations, what I'm calling kind of breadth conversations in over 200 counties in these four states, that create some intriguing patterns as well as openings for what is, as of 2010, are some really great openings for civic society. So I'm hoping that'll be compelling. Then the middle period is really running around madly and doing this and making it look easy and fun. And then the closing period is in each state. The stakeholders team understand that they need to come together for a meeting in November to really decide what it was accomplished and what do you want to do from here. And, you know, so really they've got to make some of their own decisions around that. At the same time, I did commit to trying to map what's out there in terms of current progressive rural infrastructure. And actually, and you may know differently, in which case I would love it, there is, amongst rural organizations, there is no kind of directory that you would expect as being self-evident to find peers. And almost all of these organizations are very specific around farm policy, around watershed policy, and wouldn't touch, you know, with a with anything, kind of, you know, talking about these culture war kinds of issues. So trying to both test and push that, as well as quantify what are the resources that are out there. In terms of, you know, resolution and ways that we might work together, there is no plan for 2011. And, you know, to me, I really see this as a five-year project and totally recognize that I'm very, very lucky to have a one-year period to kind of play with this. But, you know, I feel very, very committed to look at what are the ways that we've proven enough that someone wants to say, that's cool, let's keep it going. You know, so, you know, yesterday as we were talking a little bit about Texas, one of the states that, you know, Bill's looking at more in his program area, you know, there's 243 counties in Texas. Yeah. Kentucky has over 140. You know, try closing out a will in those states. But anyway, is what would be the ways to try and create some real solidarity amongst the players that are coming together as being core, to also be looking at a county-by-county model. So I'm very interested in your ideas because I'm a practitioner, I'm an organizer, and I'm, you know, one of the reasons ROP is so lean and mean is so that we don't have to raise money. You know, it's not just that was a good structure. It's that I know how to raise under $200,000 a year, and we do pretty darn well with that. So how can we maintain kind of baseline funding and yet be more available in other states? So as you have ideas, I would love to hear them.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you, Mercy, for a terrific presentation.
Thanks, everyone.